Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. In Sweden, hundreds of refugee children have fallen unconscious after being informed that their families will be expelled from the country. Seemingly, the trauma of deportation has induced a mysterious condition in these children. This is a story about something termed resignation syndrome, which is said to exist only in Sweden and only among refugees. The patients seem to lose the will to live. In a world where record numbers of people are fleeing from wars, droughts, and famine, I think we need to learn from these children. I hope you find this article from The New Yorker, written by Rachel Aviv, as interesting as I did. And this was in the April 3rd, 2017 New Yorker. Georgi, a Russian refugee who came to Sweden with his family when he was 5 years old, could talk at length about the virtues of the Volvo. His doctor described him as the most Swedified in his family. He was also one of the most popular boys in his class. For his 13th birthday, two friends listed some of the qualities that he evoked. Energetic, fun, happy all the time, good human being, amazingly kind, awesome at soccer, sly. Georgi's father, Soslan, had helped found a pacifist religious sect in North Ossetia, a Russian province that borders Georgia. Soslan said that in 2007, security forces demanded that he disband the sect, which rejected the entanglement of the Russian Orthodox Church with the state and threatened to kill him if he refused. He fled to Sweden with his wife, Regina, and their two children, and applied for asylum, but his claim was denied because the Swedish Migration Board said that he hadn't proved that he would be persecuted if he returned to Russia. Sweden permits refugees to reapply for asylum, and in 2014, having lived in hiding in central Sweden for 6 years, the family tried again. They argued that they were now particularly distressing circumstances, a provision that allowed the board to consider how deportation will affect a child's psychological health. It would be devastating if Georgi were forced to leave his community, his friends, his school, and his life, the headmaster of Georgi's school, Rickard Floridan, wrote in a letter to the board. He described Georgi as an example to all classmates, a student who spoke in mature and nuanced language and showed a deep gratitude for the school. In the summer of 2015, shortly before he entered seventh grade, Georgi learned that the Migration Board had rejected his family's application again. The news came in a letter, which he translated for his parents who couldn't read Swedish. They appealed the board's decision, and Georgi tried to focus on school as he waited for more news. Not long afterward, a friend on his floor hockey team stopped coming to practice. Georgi was distraught when he learned that the teammate, a refugee from Afghanistan, had been deported with his family, as if they were criminals, he said. Georgi became sullen and aloof, and he stopped speaking Russian. He said that the words were just sounds whose meaning he could no longer decipher. He withdrew from his parents, whom he accused of having failed to assimilate. His 9-year-old brother, Savil, acted as the family's interpreter. "Why haven't you been learning Swedish?" Georgi said in Swedish to his brother, who translated the words into Russian for their parents. In December 2015, the Migration Board rejected their final appeal and in a letter told the family, "You must leave Sweden." Their deportation to Russia was scheduled for April. Soslan said that to his children, Russia might as well be the moon. Georgi read the letter silently, dropped it on the floor, went upstairs to his room, and lay down on the bed. He said that his body began to feel as if it were entirely liquid. His limbs felt soft and porous. All he wanted to do was close his eyes. Even swallowing required an effort that he didn't feel he could muster. He felt a deep pressure in his brain and in his ears. He turned toward the wall and pounded his fist against it. In the morning, he refused to get out of bed or to eat. Saville poured Coca-Cola into a teaspoon and fed Georgie small sips. The soda dribbled down his chin. At the recommendation of neighbors, Georgie's parents called Elizabeth Holtkrantz, an ear, nose, and throat doctor who volunteers for the charity Doctors of the World. 3 days after Georgie took to his bed, Holtkrantz drove to his home, a red wooden cottage with a white trim in the farmlands of Garpenberg, 120 miles northwest of Stockholm. Georgie was wearing boxers and short athletic socks. He appeared to be asleep. A tulip-pattern blanket had been pulled up to his chin. When Holtkrantz touched him, his eyelids trembled, but he didn't move. Using a pillow, she propped up his head, but it flopped to the side. "He provides no contact whatsoever," she wrote. After a week, Georgie had lost 13 pounds. Holtkrantz, a professor emeritus at Linköping University, urged the family to take him to the emergency room in Falun, a city 40 miles away. He hadn't eaten for 4 days and had not spoken a full sentence in a week. A doctor at the hospital wrote that Georgie lies completely still on the examination table. His reflexes were intact and his pulse and blood pressure were normal. The doctor lifted Georgie's wrists a few inches above his forehead and then dropped them. "They fall down on his face," she wrote. A nurse noted that he showed no reaction to caregiving. The next day, a doctor inserted a feeding tube through Georgie's nostril. "He showed no resistance," Suslin said. "Nothing." Georgie was given a diagnosis of Opgivenhet syndrome, or resignation syndrome, an illness that is said to exist only in Sweden and only among refugees. The patients have no underlying physical or neurological disease, but they seem to have lost the will to live. The Swedish refer to them as de apathiska, the apathetic. "I think it is a form of protection. This coma they are in," Holtkrantz said. "They are like Snow White. They just fall away from the world." The apathetic children began showing up in Swedish emergency rooms in the early 2000s. Their parents were convinced that they were dying. Of what they didn't know, they worried about cholera or some unknown plague. Soon, patients with the condition filled all the beds in Stockholm's only psychiatric inpatient unit for children at Karolinska University Hospital. Goran Bodegaard, the director of the unit, told me that he felt claustrophobic when he entered the rooms. "The blinds were drawn and the lights were off. The mothers whispered, rarely spoke to their sick children, and stared into the darkness." By 2005, more than 400 children, most between the ages of 8 and 15, had fallen into the condition. In the medical journal Acta Pediatrica, Bodegaard described the typical patient as totally passive, immobile, lacks tonus, withdrawn, mute, unable to eat and drink, incontinent, and not reacting to physical stimuli or pain. Nearly all the children had emigrated from former Soviet and Yugoslav states, and a disproportionate number were Roma or Uyghur. And that is spelled U-Y-G-H-U-R, and I don't know how to pronounce that. Sweden has been a haven for refugees since the 70s, accepting more asylum seekers per capita than any other European nation. But the country's definition of political refugees had recently narrowed. Families fleeing countries that were not at war were often denied asylum. In an open letter to the Swedish Minister of Migration, 42 psychiatrists asserted that the new restrictions on asylum seekers and the time it took the Migration Board to process their applications, children could be in limbo for years, were causing the disease. They accused the government of systematic public child abuse. Opinion within the medical community converged on the theory that the illness was a reaction to two traumas: harassment in the children's home country, and the dread, after acclimating to Swedish society, of returning. Sweden's leading medical journal, Läkartidningen, devoted dozens of articles and several poems to the syndrome. "Your eyes had seen it all, aged with an old man's weariness, without any hope of life in the future," Mildred Uden, the chief of child psychiatry in Skövde in central Sweden, wrote. Magnus Kyllbom, the director of an Institute for Child Psychiatry in Stockholm, proposed in the journal that the disorder represented a kind of willed dying. Kyllbom cited the psychiatrist Bruno Bettelheim, a Holocaust survivor, who wrote that some prisoners in the concentration camps were so totally exhausted, both physically and emotionally, that they had given the environment total power over them. They stopped eating, sat mute and motionless in corners, and expired. Swedish news programs broadcast footage of children on stretchers being loaded into airplanes and expelled from the country. Sweden prides itself on its commitment to helping the most vulnerable, and the illness was seen as an affront to the country's national character. Even the king was alarmed. "It's terrible what is happening to these poor children," he told the press in 2005. A psychologist tracked down an apathetic boy who had been deported to Serbia and found him 6 months later, still unconscious, his skin sallow, in a one-room house with no running water. 160,000 Swedes signed a petition to stop the deportations of apathetic children and other asylum seekers. Five of Sweden's seven political parties demanded amnesty for apathetic patients. On the television program Mission Investigate, Gellert Tamas, one of the country's best-known journalists, reported, "The issue is only a few hours from bringing down the government." The Swedish parliament passed a temporary act that gave 30,000 people whose deportations were pending the right to have the migration board review their applications again. The board began allowing apathetic children and their families to stay. In a 130-page report on the condition, commissioned by the government and published in 2006, a team of psychologists, political scientists, and sociologists hypothesized that it was a culture-bound syndrome, a psychological illness endemic to a specific society. Every culture possesses what Edward Shorter, a medical historian at the University of Toronto, calls a symptom repertoire, a range of physical symptoms available to the unconscious mind for the physical expression of psychological conflict. In parts of India, patients are said to suffer from DAT syndrome. They complain of impotence and have the delusion that they are losing their semen. In Nigeria, students who can't retain information and report feeling a burning sensation in their heads are sometimes given a diagnosis of brain fag. The illnesses are reinforced by a local belief that the symptoms are a sign of authentic suffering, worthy of expert attention and care. The Swedish government's report proposed that the apathetic children were from holistic cultures, where it is difficult to draw boundaries between the individual's private sphere and the collective domain. They were sacrificing themselves for their family by losing consciousness. Even if no direct encouragement or directive is given, the report said, many children raised with holistic thinking may nonetheless act according to the group's unspoken rules. The report seemed to ignore the influence of Sweden's own culture on the illness. When the Swedish government sent doctors and sociologists to visit Kosovo, Serbia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan to find out if the illness was a culturally specific way of reacting to trauma, local doctors said that they had never heard of such symptoms. Georgie's next-door neighbor, a Russian girl named Rebecca, was given a diagnosis of apathy 3 years before him. She had become ill when she was 12 after the Migration Board rejected her family's application for asylum. Elena Zapolsky, a friend of both families who lived nearby and had practiced medicine in Russia, told me that after Georgie's first day in bed, I knew it was the same sickness. Georgie spent 3 nights at the hospital in Falun before being sent home with a special supportive mattress. His friends called and texted him repeatedly, but they received no response. Georgie's teachers called his family to find out why he had been absent for a week. Floridan, the headmaster, said that Georgie's classmates were in tears when he explained what had happened. He told them, Georgie has waited such a long time to get an answer about whether he can stay here in Sweden, and he has more or less given up. He finds no meaning in school or to even exist. A physiotherapist at the hospital advised Georgie's parents to turn on the lights in his bedroom every morning and to immerse him in the daily routine of the household. Georgie was rolled to the dinner table in a wheelchair. A cushioned headrest propped up his head, though his eyes remained closed. He was fed 450 milliliters of nutrients 5 times a day through a tube. When Hultkrantz visited Georgie a month after the hospitalization, she noticed that the expression on his face had smoothed out. He no longer appeared distressed as he had in the early days of the illness. She told his parents, "This is more peaceful for him," but she was guessing. Hultkrantz, who has treated more than 40 children with apathy, empathizes with her patients so viscerally that answers to routine questions can make her cry. Her husband jokes that she treats medicine like a contact sport. She spends her days driving long distances through central Sweden, providing medical exams to refugees for free. She believes that people cannot be truly healthy unless they have trygghet, a word that in English translates as security, but which has a broader meaning in Swedish: trust, a sense of belonging, freedom from danger, anxiety, and fear. The modern Swedish welfare state was built on the idea that it must safeguard trygghet for its citizens, minimizing the risks to which they are exposed. Security is the most basic foundation of the individual, the Swedish Minister of Social Affairs explained in 1967. Nothing good has ever come out of insecurity. In a 76-page guide for treating uppgivenhet syndrome, published in 2013, the Swedish Board of Health and Welfare advises that a patient will not recover until his family has permission to live in Sweden. A permanent residency permit is considered by far the most effective treatment, the manual says. The turning point will usually be a few months to half a year after the family receives permanent residence. The guidelines draw on the Israeli sociologist Aaron Antonovsky's notion of a sense of coherence. Mental well-being, Antonovsky theorizes, depends on one's belief that life is orderly, comprehensible, structured, and predictable. Antonovsky suggests, as Freud did, that psychological illness is born of narrative incoherence, a life story veering off course. As Hultkrantz sees it, her most important task as a doctor is to be a good writer, constructing a coherent narrative from her patient's physical symptoms, which she interprets as metaphors for psychic distress. In a letter to the Migration Board, Hultkrantz wrote that Georgie suddenly fell into a deep sleep when he perceived that his final hope for the future was taken from him, a description that she recently applied to another patient. If the boy can get secure residency with his entire family, the prognosis is good and you can expect a full continuous recovery within 1 year, she wrote. If the boy does not have security, he will not wake up in whatever country he is in. A chipper, gray-haired grandmother, Hultkrantz seems unaware of her power. She sometimes encourages families to get their tubing, the feeding tube, as quickly as possible, in order to emphasize their suffering to the Migration Board. Her iPhone is full of photographs that she has taken of refugee children lying in bed. Their eyes are closed, their faces are pale, and they have an expression of dull tranquility. The Canadian philosopher Ian Hacking writes that diagnoses can become a way to be a person, to experience oneself, to live in society. Psychological illnesses often adapt to a culture's preoccupations and fears. In late 19th century Europe, as women were resisting their social and sexual powerlessness, a new type of madwoman emerged. Diagnosed as a hysteric, she was sexually erratic and outrageous, unleashing qualities that a lady was supposed to suppress. In the 1980s in the United States, a new illness took root as doctors became increasingly aware of the prevalence of childhood sexual abuse. Thousands of women were given a diagnosis of multiple personality disorder. They discovered that they had two or more distinct personalities, at least one of which had been abused as a child. Hacking argues that it is irrelevant to ask, is it real? The better question is, What makes it possible in such and such a civilization for this to be a way to be mad? No country has responded to refugees, arguably the moral crisis of our era, with greater diligence and conscientiousness than Sweden. The apathetic children embody the country's worst fantasy of what will become of the most vulnerable if Sweden abandons its values. The children are embedded in a moral and political debate that is central to the country's identity, complete with heroes, doctors, victims, patients, and villains, those who doubt the victim's suffering. In an article about the illness that appeared in the newspaper Dagens Nyheter, Karen Johannesson, a Swedish historian, wrote, "Never had the ethics of compassion had such power, fed by vague historical guilt." This was about the whole image of Sweden, a country dripping with wealth but prepared to deport the most defenseless. From afar, the country looks like a humanitarian utopia, but for 20 years, Swedes have been arguing about the proper limits of their country's goodwill. In the past 3 years, as some 300,000 refugees, many from Syria and Afghanistan, have sought asylum, there has been a growing sense that the country can no longer afford to be beneficent. The Sweden Democrats, a party with roots in the neo-Nazi movement, has won the support of 18% of the population by claiming that immigration is degrading the country. Within the past 2 years, Sweden has introduced border controls and new restrictions on asylum seekers. A leading member of parliament announced the rules while choking back tears. For nearly two decades, a political question, what should we do about migration, has played out through the bodies of hundreds of children. The number of new cases of apathy declined in 2006 after the migration board took a more lenient approach. But the illness is still being diagnosed in dozens of children. Last year, some 60 children lost the ability to move and to speak. There is now universal consensus that the children are not faking, but no one knows why the illness is particular to Sweden. I spoke with more than 20 Swedish doctors who had either treated apathetic patients or written about them, and none of them had an explanation. Most were hesitant to even propose a hypothesis. Bjorn Axel Johansson, a child psychiatrist at Skåne University Hospital in southern Sweden, who has treated 12 apathetic children, told me, "I'm not convinced that this is only happening in Sweden. Maybe it's only being documented and discussed and published in Sweden." 37 of Georgie's classmates sent him letters. "These few weeks that you haven't been here have been so goddamn empty," Louise wrote. She said that all she wanted to do was hug him. "You're the one that makes everyone happy and is friends with everyone," Oliver wrote. Georgie's classmates were dismayed that Sweden intended to deport him. "It was always in the back of our minds, but it was like a punch in the jaw when we heard them say it," Lilla Lisa told him. Teachers from Georgie's school visited once a week and read him novels and excerpts from his textbooks, and his friends visited in groups of two and three, carrying on conversations by his bedside. Although psychiatrists do not know whether apathetic children can process language, they recommend that patients be treated as if they were sentient. Floridan said that he told Georgie, "We are longing for you." He thought that he could detect Georgie's eyes moving under the closed lids. Georgie's mother, Regina, a beautiful, delicate-featured woman prone to headaches, became withdrawn and depressed. Saville stopped going to school. A doctor from Falun Hospital wrote that Saville was consumed by fear and anxiety that he will be picked up by the police and deported. Although Hultkrantz referred to Georgie's state as a coma, she acknowledged that the term wasn't quite accurate. Each time she visited, she rubbed his sternum and applied pressure to his fingernails, tests that elicit responses in comatose patients, but he didn't move. Then she stroked the sole of one of his feet, a test devised by the neurologist Joseph Babinski, as a way to determine whether a patient's paralysis is organic or hysterical. Georgie curled his big toe, an indication that there was no structural damage to his brain. In April, 4 months after Georgie became ill, the family's deportation was postponed because his dependence on the feeding tube made flying hazardous. He seemed to be sinking deeper into the condition. Hultkranz observed that he had begun to drool. At Falun Hospital, a doctor noted that Georgi had no muscle tone in either the arms or legs, and that his arm reflexes were difficult to trigger. The doctor wrote, "The boy is alive, but barely." Last fall, Hultkranz took me to meet two sisters, Roma girls from Kosovo, who were both apathetic. Dinara, the younger of the two, had been bedridden and unresponsive for 2.5 years, since she was 12. In a letter to the Migration Board in October 2015, Hultkranz warned, "The only thing that can help the whole family get out of their sense of powerlessness is if they can be guaranteed security." A year later, the family's application for residency was rejected, and within 24 hours, Janita's sister, Abedeta, who was 15, lost the ability to walk. Her father, Muhorim, tried to force her to go to school by putting her on the seat of her bicycle and pushing it. By the time they got to the school, Abedeta was limp. Muharram carried her home and put her in bed, where she had remained for the past 5 months. The family lives in central Sweden, in a brick dormitory that houses refugees. When we visited, the two girls had taken over the only bedroom in the apartment. They lay side by side on twin beds that had been pushed together in the middle of the room. Beside their beds was a package of diapers. Their heads, centered on their pillows, were tilted toward the window. Snow was falling, the first of the season. Janetta had a feeding tube through her right nostril and Ibedeta through her left. Their long black hair had recently been combed. At the family's interview with the Migration Board in 2014, their mother, Nurij, had explained that in Kosovo, her children had been harassed for being gypsies. "We are Roma, and we have no country, and we are badly treated," she said. She told the Migration Board that they couldn't return to Kosovo because there's no life. She didn't have the documentation to substantiate her claims, but her daughters now embodied the sentiment. And that is where we need to leave this article for this week. We will finish it up next week. And I forgot to tell you the title in the New Yorker of April 3rd. It is called The Apathetic. Thank you for tuning into Soundbody today. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Soundbody, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig. And I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.